pleased to introduce from Fairchild Entertainment, Mr. Jerry Lawson, whose idea was to create a system with separate cartridges, and Mr. Richard Moyer, who was one of the programmers on that system.
I guess I'll start it off.
You did start it off, didn't you?
Yeah. There's an old expression about what pioneers were, and I guess I was a pioneer, and they say, well, a pioneer is a guy that goes out and comes back with all the arrows in his back. But those things happen. And one of the things that tried to enlighten you as to the genre of what took place in that time period was I, on my own with a couple of associates, had taken on a challenge that the microprocessor could be used to control video imagery. And before that time, most people had concluded it was too slow. And we said, no, you don't have to operate at a bit rate, you operate at a frame rate. And proving that you could use a memory to put symbology in it, that we set on making a coin-op game, which we called Demolition Derby. And the Demolition Derby game had also unique hand controllers, that the hand controllers were optically encoded. Because one of the things that was happening was that people were breaking the controls because of metal-to-metal contact. And we made the controls so that they were only optically coupled to eliminate peak contact to break them up. We also invented a condition we called a coin drop. A lot of the games were being defeated by kids using a piezoelectric charging device where they would walk up to the coin box and zap it with a high voltage spark, and the digital logic would trip and they'd get a free game. Well, with ours, you couldn't do that because what happened was we actually came up with a software routine that when the coin was dropped into the slot, when it went through the slot, it contacted a switch for a certain period of time. And if it didn't fit that time criteria, we rejected the game start. So we called it our drop coin attitude, and we had that in the game. And the game was put out, and I was still legally employed by Fairchild. And when the word got out I did it, Fairchild came to me and said, well, why don't you do it for us? And we have a contact with another company that's doing some stuff for us. We want you to get together. And the concept, too, was to use a microprocessor called the F8, which was an 8-bit microprocessor that at that time was one of the few that would only take two chips to make an entire microprocessor computerized set. And we used that concept that we made the device and used special joysticks. Now, that was the biggest problem with the joystick functions, that they weren't pots. They were switch contacts. And again, we came up with a software routine that closing the contacts for a certain period of time would act like it was a pot being varied from one position to another, but we're driving the symbology around. And it was an eight-way hand controller. It actually went up, down, left, right, forward and backward, and left to right. But it produced a lot of problems that the playmanship of it got to be very difficult for most people and some people, and wasn't a good plus for it. We did produce two models of the game, and up to 21 cartridges were produced, some of which were blackjack. We made a game which was called Maze. A guy by the name of Mike Glass worked on that, one of the programmers. And Maze was a precursor to Pac-Man. It did the same thing Pac-Man did. Again, we never received credit for it. The other thing we did in the Fairchild game is that we actually had a broadcast TV version. It was called TV POW. And that people could at home could look at the game, which we call Shooting Gallery. And when they were called by the MC on the TV show, their concept was they would hold onto their phone, and when they saw time to fire, they'd go POW. And it would fire a projector onto the screen, and everybody could watch him miss or hit the target. And we had that out first. Then teleprompter came to us, and we had the world's first downloadable game function. We had a library computer that was kept in Santa Clara feeding the cable system. And we had built a special receiver, and the receiver had an output cartridge that plugged into the game. and you could actually see the library of games, select which game you wanted, download it in a position, and play it. We did that in 1974. Well, after that, I left Fairchild to form my own company, which was known as VideoSoft. And at VideoSoft, we produced a couple of cartridges, one of which was called Color Bar Generator. I just found out one of them sold for $350 today. How's what?
I bought it when your signature.
You did, right? Okay. Well, we've got a ticker here. The other thing we did was we made a 3D cartridge. And it used what they call analytic 3D, which is a red and blue glasses. And we actually had, it was called Polder Ghost. And the concept was you got to shoot ghosts in the windows of a haunted house, but you had to be in the same dimension by moving the hand controller in and out, not just hit them. If you were in the wrong dimension, it would miss. So he had depth perception as to where the target was. So, again, that's it. I mean, anybody got any questions or anything else I can tell you about the wonderful days of games? Yeah.
I got a question here. How many people have played the Channel F?
Oh, a couple of them. Oh, yeah. Diehards, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, he had a question first.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Well, one of the questions I had is I've seen a number of these units where, you know, like if you, this was a good example of a system where you didn't want to remove the cartridge while the thing was on,
or
you didn't have to plug it in when it was on. So it blows something out. Recall any details about
what the failure? We designed an overkill function in it. Okay, the reason why we were very, very afraid of static charge, of possible trip and shorts entering into the microprocessor. What that connector did, which a lot of people didn't appreciate, it was a special zero force insertion connector. And it was made to wipe ground and VCC first before injecting all the other pins. Okay? It actually went into a mechanism. It would open the door of the mechanism. And then the connector itself rotated up to make contact. Okay? So it was a true zero-force insertion socket. When the Atari came along, the Atari just used a simple edge connector to plug straight in. Ours was much more complicated and much more expensive because we did an overkill because we didn't have enough statistical analysis to know what would happen. Okay? And in truth, some of them may have blown up, but we couldn't prove it was that.
The first thing I want to say is that the Fairchild Channel F was the first video game system I ever owned as a child. And I actually convinced my family and my parents to sell our piano.
Please don't blame me for your piano prodigy now.
As a result, I have a career in video games.
And can you play the piano?
Can you play the piano?
Well, I don't play the piano, but I can program up a storm. Started my first full-time program job was when I was 14, so I'm 39 now. So the channel of time got started. But the actual question I had about the channel up was that, you know, contrary to what the gentleman in the front was saying, I had a lot of fun jacking that cartridge in and out before, you know, while in the wrong mode, like while it was painting the screen or doing other really weird stuff to it. And I got it to do some very strange things where it was like playing games that never existed.
Well, that...
what that was.
I'm going to tell you what that was. There was a guy, we haven't seen him, in fact, I was just asked about him, and I mentioned him one time. His name was Mike Glass. And Mike Glass was a brilliant games programmer. So was Rich. And he did some things that were a little different, okay? And because of the way that system was engaged, that before you did a reset, some weird things would happen. For example, I got a cartridge back one day from the service department, and they brought it over, and they said, you need to plug this in and look at it. I said, okay. So I plugged it into my game in my office, and I looked, and I said, oh, my God. So I called Mike Glass, and I told him, come over here now. What I had on my screen, it would say, programmed by Mike Glass. And what had happened was this cartridge had stuck in a mode that we still don't understand how it did that. but it brought up this program, that he, this graphics function. Okay? Then he showed me how to bring it up. And what his big happiness was as a programmer, he would go into the stores, and there's a routine of pushing the engagement buttons, he knew. And he would push them right time, they would come up with the sign programmed by Mike Glass and flash. So he would go into the stores, and that's what he would do, because he knew the code. But
I never had that happen. What I had happen was like things like where, you know how you turn the controller, you get, you know, on some games you get a paddle to turn.
Yeah.
I'd get like a little paddle turning in the corner or something like that while the rest of the screen was garbage. Or it would be like it would paint itself multiple times with different colored garbage. And it was like performance art or something like that.
No, it wasn't meant to be that way, no. In fact, we had one that was really funny. I had a guy call me one day, and he was really upset because he had blackjack. Okay, now in blackjack we had a mode where we'd put up an S, which meant to start, and it would tell you, do you want to hit? Well, they weren't lined up the same way, and one day it brought up the S and hit. And he swore it was something we had done because he was doing something stupid in the game, right? And he finally said, came up and said that. He went, Lawson! Because they all blamed me for another one, too. There was a joke in the original cartridge. And the joke was, when you lost a tic-tac-toe, it said, you lose turkey.
I remember that.
Well, the guy that did that knew that at that time, that was my favorite word. hey, turkey. You know, that was my word. Uh-huh. And he did it as a joke. And we left it in. And the people would say, oh, what's that mean? You know, turkey. That's what it means, right? But I know it's interesting. We were talking to my wife about it, was that my kids were our marketing department. They never realized that they were the test market kids. And one of the things they did was that they would find flaws in the game and not tell you about the flaws. They would make games out of the flaws. Okay? One flaw we had in the game that Mike made, which was called Maze, okay, that I told was the precursor to Pac-Man. They would do things like, I watched my son one day chase the cat around. Now the cat used to come into the maze and would eat you, right? You know, the game is over. I watched my son chase the cat, and I said, how's he doing that, right? So I looked at him and I said, Mark, you can't do that. He says, how do you know where the cat's going to go? He says, I know every move he's going to make. But the mazes are calculated. There's 10,000 different mazes. How do you know where he's going to go? He says, I know how to get the same maze every time. How? He said, I hold the reset button, then hold button one and let go the reset button. I always get the same maze. I said, you stinker. All right? And he said, well, then the cat always goes this way, this way, this way, he doesn't know about this, so I'll sit there and wait and pass and check and run around behind him. Then he had another thing that him and his sister would make, is they would say they could make the cat get sick. I said, now how do you make the cat get sick? They would go over and sacrifice one of the players, and the cat would gobble him and go right through the wall of the maze and end up on the outside of the maze and go boom, 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 couldn't get back. And they called it making the cat sick. So I used to tell them, I said, we want to find the flaws in these games. We don't want you to make games out of the flaws, right? The kids would. They would find things to do with games that would just blow you apart. And when the Atari game came out, I'll never forget, or Nintendo, if they played them and they'd see me, they'd go, oh, this game stinks. Yeah, this is no good. This is no good. Right? Yeah. What about Rick? What are you doing these days?
I'm back into video games.
Oh, great. Great. Incidentally, I just want to say one thing. This gentleman did the first breakout game on the Fairchild, which was really a difficult thing to do, but it was an excellent game he made up. He was with the group. What year was that you in? Anyhow, I can't even remember years anymore.
It's hard to remember the years.
Yeah. They go by.
It was Cart 17 was the first one, mm-hmm. And I think 18 was Pinball the Challenge, Hangman, and then there was later on there was a Pro Football, which
yes.
was after the disappearance of Into Zircon. And
oh yeah, when they all went bye-bye Into Zircon. That was a company that picked up on all the Fairchild stuff after Fairchild just gave up the ghost. One of the interesting things in the electronics business, and happens over and over again, semiconductor people get involved in different businesses they don't understand, and they don't stay in there for the long haul. They get technology, gets them to move in these different areas, and they in that area they don't understand how to market products in that area, so they usually fall miserably. And we had the watch business, and for example, watches first came out, they had LED light up watches. Now, some of you remember those wonderful watches. I used to call the LED watch is the watch that keeps giving and giving and giving and giving. Everyone you gave to somebody within a month, the batteries were dead because they went around town doing this all the time, all right? So wearing out the batteries. The other thing is that every time daylight savings time changed, they call you because they couldn't set the watch. So it got so that when I had a bunch of watches, a whole case of them, I had a form made up. And in the form, I had them sign the form. And then they had if they received the watch from me, they had to agree not to call me. Now, I don't change batteries or set them for them. And if they sign that, you can have the watch. Otherwise, no good.
This watch thing actually affected the Fairchild Game Company because we were often consumer vision. Fairchild, you know, was this thing that made semiconductors, made microprocessors. That was their big deal. But they had the consumer division. They're going to try watches. And watches was, I guess, 10 times as big as the game company. So they were the dog and we were the tail. Mm-hmm. So when watches went kaput and lost millions of dollars, they decided to just throw away the consumer division. Now, is that why they never decided to make a... I mean, they could have made an improvement to the Fairchild game system.
Well, the problem, Rick, was that they never, ever could stick to a plan, okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, we all predicted that the game business would go into a lull and come back out. And all they had to do was keep improving, come out with newer models, all right? And they would set the pace. But they couldn't do that. And they never had the wherewithal to understand how to market a system. For instance, a good marketing story I can tell you is that when we first introduced the Channel F game, the day after Christmas in the consumer business is called Hell Day. And that's the day you get all the calls, all the customer problems come up. Our marketing department, sales department took off. I made the mistake of coming to work the day after Christmas. And the only person in the plant is me and the guard, right? Well, the phone started ringing off the hook. I got calls like one woman wanted to know would dog urine hurt the game. Another one said, what would false teeth do? They got locked inside the chute mechanism. We had another customer who was gleefully taking his file and carving down an 8-track stereo tape trying to put it in so he could play his favorite music on the game. Well, another guy called and said, I can't find where the batteries go. What batteries? I've taken it apart and I still can't find the batteries. I said, it has a thing that plugs in the wall. It doesn't take batteries, right? Now, after I'm not dealing with the public too well, and after about 8 hours of this, you start to get a little tainted, right? A little jaded, you know? And finally, one day, this one woman calls up and she said, my game hums! Do you know why? And I said, because I don't know the words, lady. There are several examples of that. We haven't had, it's interesting to see how the public reacts. We had a guy one time return a game that didn't work, and the service department brought over and said, we got a game you got to see. The guy had taken out the game, PC board, out of the game. He had put in a piece of phenolic board, copperclad board. He had weighted it down with solder and glued the controls back into place that it looked like was in there. I said, what a dummy. He said, if you'd called me, I'd have given him a damn board after all this. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, it's kind of a... It's, you know, if you sit down and think about... things that happen in the electronics industry, that it's rather interesting to watch things rise and fall and go out of sorts. Like when Atari 2600 games were hot in the 80s, everybody was in the cartridge business. And what happened was Activision and iMagic was getting sued by Atari. And I got involved as an expert witness to look into some design characteristics. Well, as a result of it, I came up with how to do the program. The program is manual for the Atari 2600. Well, after they had settled the case, I said, what do I do with this? And they said, public domain, since you reverse engineered it, right? For a while, some people were getting big bucks for that book. There were several people that reverse engineered, and it yielded several companies that started making games as a result of it, all over the world. And I think, again, that we didn't keep pace, the industry didn't keep pace for a while for what was the next criteria to go. But now it's back where I think you couldn't give away ROM cartridges these days. It's all back now to CDs and what have you, compact disc, that kind of system. What are you working for now as a game developer? You're doing your own, or are you working for a company?
I'm going to do the next one, whatever it is.
The next game company?
Yeah.
Oh, all right.
Any
that's
questions
cool
out there? Or?
In the Fairchild Entertainment System, it was a frame buffer.
Could you use a dynamic RAM of 4K? Yeah, well, we did that because it was easier to deal with it than trying to real time. The Fairchild used a buffered memory to store all the imagery and move it. The Atari used sprites, which are control beam iterations, okay, where you can control where it went.
So how much did all that screen RAM cost?
Well, originally, the biggest problem was the cost of RAM memory. And just to give you an example how things were all fouled up, I was paying nothing for the RAMs originally. Because what I was doing is that Fairchild had a division that made the 4K RAM, and they were throwing them out. They didn't pass their test. And my criteria for using them was much less, so I would go up and get... I literally had a red wagon, and I would fill it up with RAMs and boxes and take it back and test it to my spec, and I was getting 95% yield. They found out about it, and they started to charge me. And it just showed how interesting things that happened to semiconductor companies that the big boys got and decided to do negotiations, so they negotiated a beautiful price of $2 per unit. So that was costing us $8 in memories on the unit. Now, about maybe a year into production, even Fairchild couldn't produce the RAMs. So I asked for permission to go to Intel. And I called the Intel salesman, who was an old friend, telling him we need RAMs. And he looked at me like I'm crazy, right? He said, what does Fairchild need RAMs for? I said, we need RAMs, right? So he gave me a quote with the spec I gave him. And he thought he was really high-handing me because he brought back the spec the next day and the quote handed it to me and said, no negotiation. You got to pay this or nothing. I said, okay. I looked at it, and I called them various names. As I looked at the price, my eyeballs almost fell out of my head. The price was $1.05. And I was paying $2 from Fairchild, my own company. And when I showed it to my boss, he went, oh, my God. I said, do you think maybe we're getting shafted by our own company?
Well, that's interesting, because the Atari said that they went to this new system because they didn't want to spend the money for a frame buffer. It doesn't sound that expensive.
Well, the frame buffer itself was relatively expensive compared to what you can do in other ways. Okay? Mm-hmm. Because that was still a fixed charge of about $1 to $2 for the frame buffer per unit. Mm-hmm. And in order to get higher density, you'd still have to... You had to go times four. You couldn't just double it. Okay? Because when you wanted to get more resolution, doubling it would only give it to you in one axis.
Yep.
So you had to go in four.
If they had gone four, it would have been competitive with the Atari.
It would have been. It would have been. The only fact, actually, there were some things that we could do that the Atari system couldn't do.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You have a lot of different dots on the
screen. Yeah.
We could control more imagery, things we could put on the screen than they could. Okay? If because, like, for instance, they could never do blackjack like we did it. All right. So there's a whole lot of limitations to the Atari system. But again, like I said, if you don't stick your guns and stay in there, you know, you're going to lose. Any more questions? No, we'll time for many more. One more.
Go.
What was you and what was it like in the development house?
It was a much smaller room than this. It was just a small, well, a few offices, and we were all, most of us were in one main room. There were two or three hardware engineers. Jerry, I don't know if you were in that office or somewhere else.
I was in the tower, remember?
Yeah, somewhere else. Okay, yeah. He would come over. And two or three hardware engineers making the next version or else playing something. I don't know what they were doing. But and then the software guys, Vilas Munchie started. And
there was Vilas, there was you, there was Don Ruffcorn, Mike Glass.
And then later on,
Fletcher.
Added Brad Fuller and somebody else.
Brad, yes.
Oh, Brad.
Yes.
Yeah. And somebody else. So there are probably maybe four software engineers at a time.
Well, Fairchild was not noted for, you know, Atari had 10 times as many people, and they actually made an investment in something. But Fairchild wouldn't do it, huh?
Vilas, Munchie, and Brad both went to Atari.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay.
Brad actually stayed on and was basically did the sound and music for a lot of the home computer games, and then eventually went out there as well.
Well, the guy who was very, very talented program, we got lost track and we're trying to figure out where he is, was Don Ruffcorn.
Oh, I know Don.
You do?
Yeah, I see Don.
And Don was an interesting character.
Yeah, Don was an interesting character, and he could throw up some hardware that, in a few weeks or less than a week to make something prototype to start working, and then people go off and fix it and fill in the blanks and everything. But he could just get what was needed working there.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike Glass was in a category by himself. I mean,
Mike Glass
you had
close
Dave,
to being
Dave
crazy.
Dave Crane at Atari was, you know, that single-mindedness that could get something done. And but like, Mike Glass, you wondered if it was safe to be next to him, but you sure admired him.
He worked, when I started VideoSoft, he was one of the first programmers I hired for VideoSoft. And he physically lived outside of VideoSoft in his van. We didn't need a night watchman. He was the guy. And Mike would do things like he would go in the bathroom and he would get mad and kick a hole in the wall. Okay? And one day I came in and found a hole in the wall. I said, Mike, he said, yeah, you kicked a hole in the wall? Yeah. You know what that means? I'm going to fix it. Go ahead. Right? But he did brilliant things. In fact, in the Mattel system, he did some graphic things that Mattel was just flabbergasted that they could get that kind of resolution. He was the guy that came up with one of the things he did with the F8 microprocessors. He only had 64 bits of resonant RAM.
64 bytes.
Yeah. And he found another 4 bytes. And I said, come on, Mike, where'd you find the 4 bytes? They're in there. Come on, where are they? What he did is he found out since the I.O. ports to the processor were there and we didn't use them, and they were latched, their memories. So he would go out and latch the I.O. ports and use them for RAM. I said, you stinker. I mean, he came up with ideas like that and followed through with them. One of the things that he never got recognized for is that he had a game called Spitfire. And Spitfire was featured in a movie. The movie is called The Fury with Kurt Douglas. And there's a scene in the movie Fury where these kids are playing Spitfire. Well, the game of Spitfire was an airplane, that one airplane could be flown by the computer, the other one could be flown by the player. And if you shot down the plane consistently, the plane would get faster. And if you missed it a couple of times, the plane would slow down. So it was truly interactive. And at that time, the people didn't have interactive games. And Mike came up with that system. And Mike Hazen worked on the 3D polar ghost thing, where you had to be in the right plane to fire and shoot this thing. But he came up with some brilliant ideas and things. He was really, there's a contribution to call a guy who writes games as a programmer is a misstatement. I think they should be considered the gamesters, okay? Because it isn't enough just to know how to program the machine. It's to understand what the attributes of a game are all about. What do you do? So that's not easy. I wrote a game one time, and it was just, I thought it was a joke, but it turned out to be a hit. But I said, because all I did was take a bullet, and instead of erasing the bullet, it said, it's a ray now, because I don't erase it, let it go straight out, right? Changed some functions on it, and people said, oh, that's a cool game. I said, good Lord, you know. I was not a game player. I used to do programming as a hardware guy. You know, if you sit down the bowels of the machine and you had to do machine code, I'm your guy. But if you're going to write a game or do a payroll, I'm not your guy. I don't do things like that. Any other questions, guys? Go ahead.
Are we to understand that basically the video game was created just to sell the FA chip? That was the only motivation?
I heard that rumor once, but no.
No,
it was the FA chip, and the FA chip was just so terrible, the programming. When I went to Atari, I was just
so happy to be rid of it.
Didn't get rid of that chip. The chip was
there. 6502 is just so clean in comparison.
The 6502 is built more for peripheral function to be added onto. The FA actually did not allow itself for expandability too easily.
I found out later that F8, there are a lot of F8s, or were a lot of F8s in gas station pumpings.
See, there's a big difference between the people who are trying to get an event. What's the difference between a microcomputer and a microprocessor? Okay, the F8 lends itself to complete applications of a two-chip approach, a single-chip approach, to a microprocessor function. But if you're trying to expand it as a computer to do data retrieval handling, it was not the machine to use. It was sticking it in the wrong place. You take a 6502 function, and it was built to add external memory, expand the memory, do all the other functions with it. You couldn't even handle interrupts correctly on the F8. It was very difficult because it wasn't designed for that. It was designed to be a controller, and the controller was intended to be used for doing microwave ovens, gas station meters, toasters, okay? That sort of thing. It was not meant to be a microcomputer. Any other questions? What?
The entire catalog of Fairchild, were they all distributed the same amount of quantity initially, and that was it? Or they had other runs? Or how did the distribution develop? Are some games used more than the others? Or made more of all, but made the same number of units?
They were made more. I don't know what the initial runs, if they were, how they decided the initial runs.
Initial runs of the base unit or the cartridges?
The cartridges.
The cartridges were sold to outlets on a one-on-one basis instead of saying, you know, here's the outlet, just dump them out there. Because when they got past a certain amount of them, they found that people were picking and choosing about it. There's an analogy that's going on where people don't just, every new cartridge, some people, every new cartridge, they'll snatch it. But after a while, when they sit there and look at their money and say, well, we're paying $21 up for a cartridge, they started being more selective. And they would sit there and say, well, gee, I only want to use blackjack. I don't care for anything else. In fact, we found that, for instance, to give an example, we had a European partner, Saba, and they were in Germany. And we built the game. They built the game, sent them the parts, all that, and they were marketing it in Germany. And Saba got into trouble, said it wasn't selling too well because they found that the people were interested in certain games. They just didn't sell well, right? So Saba came back and said, we want a chess game. And they had to have a chess game to sell the console. And what they were doing was they were packaging the chess game cartridge with the console and calling it a chess game. And they said they were getting more action that way than trying to sell it and say, here's a chess cartridge, add it in. So then they were coming back later and saying, well, incidentally, it will do something besides play chess. Okay. So that was their approach at marketing it. But again, like I said, it's interesting. We were talking about just this the other day with Al Alcorn. People, there's the sum of the parts sometimes costs more than the part itself, the whole unit. For example, PCs right now, if you break them up and sell the parts out individually, you can probably get more money than you can put it all together. And this has happened a lot because what is perceived is that, hey, I need this power supply. I'll pay for that power supply and I can't get it from anybody else, so they might pay more money for it than to go buy it that's already in a unit and pull it out. Right now, there's a thing happening in the industry that's pretty rare, is that Apple is selling the iPod? The drive that goes in an iPod, you cannot buy it OEM cheap enough. So people are going out and buying the iPods and taking the drive out. And glad to get them. Okay? So this happens in the industry because what happens is supply and demand. Everybody's pushing units for iPod. That's it. And the regular market can't get them. And if they can get them, it's price prohibitive. So a lot of people are buying these things, but they're just stripping the drive out. So sooner or later, you'll see iPods with no drives in them. By the thousands. Okay? In fact, if Apple got smart, they'd start shipping dummy iPods with drives in them. Yes? Yeah, the light in the cartridge? Yeah. The light was to indicate that it was in progress doing something. The moves after a while took so long that we were afraid people would sit there and go, oh, God, it ain't working, right? So it gave them a think light, right? But, you know, it's interesting how people regard it. One of the things we had is, Mike, we had a CES show one time, and we used to go to the CES show with our newer cartridges and products. And I told Mike, look, we need something that shows how the hand controller works. People are still having trouble with the hand controller. He says, I got it, I'll do something. And he came up with a program that he would tell you, move the hand controller to the right. And if you moved it the wrong way, if you say, no, that's the left, the right. It would read direction it was going in until you correct you. Now, the way the program started is that if you push the reset button, the sign would come up immediately and said, please do not push the reset button. Okay? Very clever, right? I was at a show and I watched the guy go. "15 minutes he's doing that." And I walked to him, sir, what's going on? He said, I'm following instructions here. No, you're not, sir. It's telling you, please do not push the reset button and you keep pushing it. Huh? Oh. And you have people do that, and you just sit there and go, good Lord, why did this happen, right? But it was, you know, and some of the things that happen in the shows there, people get involved, like, would just keep you in tears laughing, because you couldn't believe people would do something like that. But I said, Murphy's Law says if they can do it, they will do it. But yes, anybody else?
I think he wants to end it.
Yeah. You want to end it, throw us out? Oh, good.